Naomi has made her, presented her reasons and her arguments to her two daughters-in-law as to why they should return back. And we saw last week that they both lifted up their voices and wept in verse 14, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye and she went. And Ruth just clung to her, clave unto her. And Naomi's going to speak one more time to Ruth, and in verse 15 it says, "And Naomi said, Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law." Now this is the third time we see that word return. It's used in verse 10, or it's actually used in verse 8, go and return each to her mother's house, and it's used in verse 10 where they say, we will return with thee, and it's used in verse, this is the third time the word return is used. When Naomi is talking to her daughters-in-law, she says, turn again, which is almost the same thing. So we find here that she says concerning Orpah, she has what? Thy sister-in-law has what? Gone back. And that just means she's turned back. Or I guess another rendering for that is, which is sad, turned away. She did turn back home, but the moment that she turned back home and turned her face toward Moab, she was turning away from those things that Ruth was clinging to, because Naomi is going to tell us what she has turned back to. Sometimes that word is used for retreat, like you're retreating from a battle. If you want to make it sound better than retreat, people will usually say in the military, fall back, instead of retreat, which gives you the idea that you've turned around and turned your back and you're running. Yeah, there's a tactical retreat. Fall back, when I hear the phrase fall back, it gives a visual picture of you're still facing forward, but you're backing up. When I think of retreat, you just turn around and go, and your back is turned to the enemy. So another word for gone back is also to retreat. She's turned back from the journey that she started. She's turned away from Naomi and Naomi's people and Naomi's God, because she's going to turn back, and if you turn back, you're going towards something. And our verse says, thy sister-in-law has gone back unto something. She's turned away from something and turned to something. She's turned unto her people and unto her gods. And you really see here, this is a deliberate choice. It's her decision. It's her choice. And the Lord a lot of times will ask us to make a choice. Circumstances will come into our lives where we don't realize it, but the Lord is really saying, like Joshua said to God's people, we read that scripture several verses back over in Joshua 24, where Joshua said, choose you this day whom you will serve. The Lord was really giving her a choice, because he doesn't want anybody to serve him that doesn't really want to serve him. And so she has really made a choice this day who it is that she's going to serve, the God of Israel or the gods of Moab. Naomi says, when she turned back, what gods that she chose, or who it is that she chose to worship. The other thing that struck me is you don't really see Naomi criticizing her for this choice. There's no, Naomi's not saying, well, look at what your sister did. There's no real criticism of Naomi by, and even of Ruth. You don't see any criticism here. She heard Naomi's arguments, and she just made that choice based upon those arguments. She saw all the obstacles that Naomi put before her, and she retreated. It's like there's a battle ahead. Those are obstacles I can't overcome, or I don't want to overcome. I'm going to retreat. But the next words that really struck me, the words that show what it is she turned to, unto her people and unto her gods really struck me, because you can divide those two things up into two things that are really strong, oh, powerful influences on the lives of people. And these are two things that really oppose spiritual choices. When she says she went unto her people, I kind of title that a national identity. Her people. It's like, this is her national identity. That's my nation. Those are my people. And that had a strong pull on her. It meant more to her than anything. And when she turned to unto her gods, that kind of shows her religious identity that she wasn't willing to let go of. You see here that they didn't worship one god in Moab. It says gods, plural. Now, just like in any culture, Moab had a god that they called their national deity. Isn't that interesting? And they were known as the people of this god. And so she's going back because that's her religious identity as well as her national identity. So turn to Numbers chapter 21 and look at verse 29, and then we're going to go over to Jeremiah. But Numbers 21 and looking at verse 29, it says here, "Woe unto thee, Moab, thou art undone, O people of who?
Chemosh.
He hath given his sons that escaped and his daughters into captivity unto Sihon, king of the Amorites." Here they are known as the people of Chemosh. He was their chief god, their national deity. When they worshipped him, first and foremost, that identified them as Moabites. That really struck me. Then over in Jeremiah 48, I think it says something similar in Jeremiah 48, and looking at verse 46. And here again it says, "Woe be unto thee, O Moab, the people of Chemosh perish. For thy sons are taken captives, and thy daughters are captives." So in Jeremiah 48, 46, it says, they are the people of Chemosh. So they are known and identified with this particular god, although they worshipped other gods. Chemosh means destroyer or subduer. He was like the king of the gods, I guess you could say. And he demanded, we know from other references in the Bible, human sacrifice. And so she was going back after 10 years. Of course, I'm not sure at what point in time she got married to Naomi's son, but she had spent possibly several years married to them, her husband, and obviously not worshipped this god or her other gods or participated or practiced in any of those practices. But you see here that Naomi is telling her sister, she's gone back to her people, and she's gone back unto her gods, because she's really never let go of them in the first place. They're still hers. Now, they worshipped other gods, just like they had a male god, Chemosh. They had a female goddess that a lot of the nations around that area worshipped. She was kind of a fertility goddess, or the moon goddess. And then they had a lot of lesser gods called Baal, which means Lord, and they worshipped all those gods. But these were things that she was not willing to let go of, and I was just struck by that, because these are obstacles. People don't want to let go of national identity, or they don't want to let go of past religious identity once they truly come into the things of the Lord. It's like, oh, no, I don't want to go all the way. I just can't let go of that. If she let go of that national identity and didn't go back to her people, then she would no longer be a Moabite. Oh no, I won't be a Moabite anymore. If I'm not a Moabite, what am I? I'm nothing. Ruth is willing to let go of that and be nothing. If she lets go, if she goes back and goes back to her gods, then she's no longer an idolater. because she's has to, had to let, she would have to let go of idolatry. If she goes back with Naomi, then it's like she takes nothing with her. I mean, I'm empty. I can't take anything with me. I'm like a clean slate. The only thing that I will have is what I receive when I get to Bethlehem, Judah. And that's hard sometimes for people to start out and just let go of everything and start out with nothing. And let the Lord then fill in those empty places and fill those things in with the things that he provides. If she doesn't go back and stays like Ruth is going to stay, she's going to be stripped of everything, I guess you could say, the flesh boasts in. This is everything that my flesh enjoys, that I can boast in, that I can take pride in. And Ruth is going to let go of that, but she's going to turn back because she doesn't want to be stripped of that. Also, the other thing you see in this verse, Naomi says, thy sister-in-law is gone back. So you get the idea that she's already headed back. You know, she's already started back on that journey. She's already begun her journey home. And Ruth, you know, is still holding on to Naomi, but her sister's already turned back. And it just reminded me of, she's turned back, and it just reminded me of all of those that you see the Apostle Paul talk about throughout the Word that started out so well and then turned back. And she's also a little bit like those that Jesus talked about in the parable in Matthew 13, that received the seed and heard the word, and for whatever reasons that are given there, and there are various reasons that are given in Matthew 13, something hindered them from really bringing forth fruit. It's not for lack of opportunity, but there's something in them or something that they saw around them that distracted them. One of the things that Jesus said would take away from the ability to bring forth fruit would be the trials, the hardships of life. And probably she looked at all the negative things that Naomi showed her and thought, there's nothing but hardship or trials ahead of me. It's not worth it. And she turned back. And then there are those that are distracted, Jesus says, by the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. Remember that in Matthew 13 in that parable? That's just the opposite of the trials. That's the good things in life, not the hard things in life, but the good things. And in going back to her gods and her people, she's going back to the good things in life, the pleasures of the flesh, the pleasures of idolatry. And a lot of people can be stirred up briefly by the bridal message or even the salvation message. And think about going that direction, and then they get distracted either by the hardness of the way or distracted by the things in the world that are so appealing to the flesh. And so she went back. I guess you could say the trials disturbed her and the pleasures distracted her. And Ruth, on the other hand, she was determined. She wasn't disturbed and she wasn't distracted. She was determined to go all the way and bring forth that full potential of fruit. Although when Ruth makes this decision, she's not going to realize what lies ahead of her at the end of that journey, and she's not going to realize how fruitful she's going to end up being or the blessings that she will have poured out upon her. But she's determined, despite of everything, the trials or the pleasures that she could go back to, she's determined to go all the way. I remember my Ryrie Bible had this little comment on that parable in Matthew 13, and it said that there are four different responses to the Word of God that Jesus talks about there. And the first is no response at all. No response. They don't respond at all. And then there is an emotional response, which I thought was really good. Oh, the joy of the moment, which we talked about, I think, last week or the week before. And then there's a worldly response, which I thought was really good. And then there's a fruitful response. And I like that because Ruth is going to give the right response.
What was the worldly response?
The worldly response, let's see, go to Matthew 13. I think I wrote that in my Bible here. Matthew 13, 22 or 23. Yeah, there is the tribulation and persecution in verse 21, Matthew 13, 21, which would be the trials. And the one before that is going the seed that was scattered by the wayside and, you know, just stony places. Verse 20 would be the receiving it with joy, which would be the emotional response. And we find in verse 21 the tribulation, persecution, and being offended by that, which goes along with that emotional response, worldly response. And then the thorns, which are the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches. That's the worldly response. So you have, you know, actually two main opposites here that you either have no reaction or you have a reaction that is emotional on two levels. Either you're emotional because, oh no, the way is hard. Or you're emotional and, oh no, the pleasures of the world are so much better. And then there is that absolute fruitfulness that Ruth is going to bring forth. So there are those that turn back. What's really going to strike me is Naomi herself is turning back in a positive way. And I was went out on a walk Monday, and I was kind of thinking about the verse where Naomi finally arrives at Bethlehem, Judah. And I got to thinking about, she'd been gone for 10 years, but she went back. And people can come go away from the things of the Lord, and they can come back. But, you know, she came back, and she was bitter. So she didn't have any good experiences to tell them about, but she did come back. So though there are people that turn away, there are people that turn back. And I was just walking around, you know, the track thinking about that. So we don't give up hope on people, and I always pray for people that have turned aside from the word that they'll turn back. What Naomi's going to tell Ruth to do here, besides saying, well, look, your sister's gone back, and look at what she's gone back to, her people and her gods. Naomi's going to say, you need to follow her example. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. And Naomi knows that if she does do what her sister-in-law does, she won't just be turning back home. Ruth knows she'll be turning away from truth, because if she goes back, it's to her people and her gods. And so I was just really struck by the fact that Ruth doesn't want to go back home. She doesn't want to turn away from truth. And she knows if she turns back, she'll be turning away from truth. So her people are no longer her people. And as she'll say later on, her gods are no longer her gods. Ruth turned back to her people and her gods in verse 15, or Orpha turned back to her people and her gods in verse 15, and Ruth is going to say, wait a minute, your people will be my people and your God will be my God. So I don't need to turn back, I'm going forward. So I'm going to let go of my national identity and my religious identity. I'm going to have a new one. And I like that. And what struck me is sometimes all the obstacles that are put before us are just there to make us realize how much we want something. And I think all those obstacles, all those reasons that Naomi gave to her two daughters-in-law, whether she realized it or not, put them to the test so that they could see and she could see, how much do you really want this? How much do you really want to go back with me? And so Ruth really wants to go. One of the commentators said, Naomi was trying to cover up. You know, he's talking about one reason she doesn't want her daughters-in-law to come back is, well, if they come back, everybody's going to know that her sons married Moabites. And that really wasn't the thing to do. And she was ashamed of that, or could have been ashamed of that. So he says, Naomi was trying to cover up, and Orpha had given up, but Ruth was prepared to stand up. And I thought that was really good. Naomi was trying to cover up and Orpha had given up, but Ruth was prepared to stand up. She refused to listen to her mother-in-law's pleas or to follow her sister-in-law's example. Why? Because she had come to trust in the God of Israel. She had experienced trials and disappointments already. You know, her husband had died. And instead of blaming God, she trusted in him and was not ashamed to confess her faith. Actually, she's a little bit more exuberant about her faith than her mother-in-law is, because her mother-in-law is going to say, boy, the Lord's really dealt bitterly with me. You don't ever see that in Ruth, but you do in her mother-in-law. She has a different attitude than even her mother-in-law does. She's had the same trials and the same disappointments, but she's not blaming God. She's trusting in him. Ruth had come to know the true and living God, and she wanted to be with his people and to dwell in his land. Ruth's conversion is evidence of the sovereign grace of God, for the only way sinners can be saved is by what? Grace. Everything within her and around her presented obstacles to her faith, and I thought that was a really good point. Everything in her and everything around her was an obstacle to going on. Yet she trusted in the God of Israel. Her background was against her, for she was from Moab and they worshipped other gods. So her background was against her. And she worshipped a God that had accepted human sacrifices. The God of Israel is going to be totally different than the God, chief God of Moab. And also their gods encouraged immorality, and the God of Israel has a different standard by which they will live. So her background was against her, and then her circumstances were against her and could have made her bitter against the God of Israel. First her father-in-law died, and then her husband and her brother-in-law died, and she was left a widow without any support. If this is the way Jehovah God treats his people, why follow him? So her circumstances were against her. Ruth dearly loved her mother-in-law, but even Naomi was against her, for she urged Ruth to return to her family and to her gods in Moab. And I thought those were three things that were really good points. Her background was against her, her circumstances were against her, and even Naomi was against her. Everything, all these obstacles were against her, and yet she is going to go on. And that shows you the attitude of heart that this woman had. Since Elimelech and Malchon were now dead, Ruth was technically under the guardianship of Naomi, and she should have obeyed her mother-in-law's counsel. But God intervened and graciously saved Ruth in spite of all these obstacles. The scripture that he quotes is Titus 3:5, which says, not by works of righteousness which we have done, but according to his what? Mercy he saved us. Titus 3:5. And the other scripture is Micah 7:18, which says, God delights in showing mercy. So Ruth is going to enter into the household of faith based upon the mercy of God. And then he says, God often shows his mercy to the least likely people in the least likely places. Isn't that true? Who would have expected God to bring a Moabitess into the household of faith who would later become an ancestor of King David and an ancestor of Jesus? So her mother-in-law has offered one last plea to Ruth, and she said, look, your sister-in-law has already gone back to her people and her gods. You need to return and follow after your sister-in-law. And Ruth answered, the word said here is translated answered, and Ruth answered, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, what? I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. And thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Remember, she's going to have to let go of her people, and she's going to have to let go of her gods, because that's what Orpha went back to. And so now she makes this stand and this statement of faith and commitment. And she answers Naomi. And you kind of see how persuasive maybe the tone of Naomi is, because she says, entreat me not, or don't urge me, don't beg me, don't beseech me to go back. You just see that tone that Naomi uses to try to persuade Ruth to go back. And she says, don't beg me to go back. She ignores all the arguments, and basically she summarizes what Naomi has asked her to do. You know, she's saying, if I go back, you're saying I'm going to have to leave you. Because she says, don't entreat me not to leave thee. So she says, basically, you're saying I need to leave you. And this is something she didn't want to do. And that word leave, you know, has three meanings that I really like that Ruth took to heart. And the first meaning that we think about in reference to leaving is forsaking. You know, you're asking me to forsake you. And the other definition for leaving, which I really like, means to commit oneself to. And so she's saying, if I leave you, you're saying I shouldn't commit myself to you. And the third definition of forsake or leave is to help. You're saying I shouldn't help you. And she wanted to do all those. She didn't want to forsake her. She wanted to commit herself to Naomi, and she wanted to help her. She really loved Naomi. She loved her, obviously, more than her own mother. So she's really saying to Naomi, you're asking me to leave you, and I don't want to do that. And then she says, you're asking me to return or to turn back or to go back to my gods and my people, and I don't want to do that either. That's something that she didn't want to do. And then she said, you're asking me to stop doing what I'm doing right now, which is follow you. Well, this is what I want to do. I don't want to leave, and I don't want to return, but I do want to follow you. And she's saying, you're asking me not to do that which I want to do, and you're asking me to do what I don't want to do. And she's able to just distinguish the three things that, the one thing that she wants to do, and that's just follow. And that means to do it in several different ways. One of the ways that you follow is to walk behind somebody, which, in a sense, Naomi has been her example. And can you imagine when they begin that journey, probably how maybe Naomi's going to really spend some time instructing her on what it will be like when she enters into the city, Bethlehem, and what the people will expect of her, how she should dress, how she should talk, how she should eat, tell her a little bit more about the customs, because maybe they weren't observing it in great detail in Moab. And so she's going to walk behind her and let her be her example, her instructor and her teacher, like a disciple walks behind a teacher. And then the other meaning for to follow after is you kind of progress a little bit, walk beside. She's going to walk beside her. And they're going to be equals in widowhood and in necessities and in needs and in dependence. So they're going to do this side by side, shoulder to shoulder, which I think is really wonderful. The other definition for follow after kind of shows the intense desire of Ruth's heart. It means to pursue. We get the word persecute from it, pursue, persecute, but it just shows there's an intensity, a relentless, I'm not going to let go or let down attitude. Remember when we went to see that musical, the Frenchman who stole the loaf of bread and the police...
Les Miserables.
The policeman that relentlessly pursued him for years and years and years. You just have the idea from pursue, following after you is, I don't care what you do, I'm going to pursue after you. So you can go on, but I'm going to trail after you. And eventually I'm going to catch up with you. So we're going to go together. So in these words, we see Ruth's commitment and what she's willing to do. She's willing to walk with Naomi because she says, whither thou goest, I will go. I'm going to walk with you. And she's willing to live with Naomi. And where thou lodgest, what?
I will lodge.
So I'm going to live with you. My Bible dictionary commentator said, this is what we see in this verse, and the next verse is kind of, it's called parallelism in Hebrew poetry. They use two things side by side. So you see, thou goest, and I will go. Thou livest, thou lodgest, and I will lodge, to present this. And so you find that she says, number one, I want to walk with you. And number two, I want to live with you. And this is her purpose of heart. I'm going to go all the way, and I'll accept whatever happens. And not only will she walk with Naomi, for whither thou goest, I will go, where you live, I will live, but there's kind of a continuation on what she says in relation to what she's willing to embrace when she gets there. You know, where you go and where you lodge kind of talks partly about what it's like as they begin that journey. They have to, you know, go from place to place, and they have to sleep at certain places, and they don't really know where they're going to end up when they get to Bethlehem, if the family home is there or what. But that kind of shows you the attitude she has for the journey and for at the end of the journey. And then when she gets to the end of the journey, you see what she's willing to embrace when she gets to Bethlehem, Judah. And your people shall be my people. So I'm going to embrace your people. Because when I leave Moab, I won't have any people. And she's going to embrace Naomi's God. Thy God shall be my God. Because I'm not going to have any gods. I'm turning away from my people just as my sister turned to them, and I'm turning away from my gods just as she turned back to them. So the Lord's replaced my people with your people and replaced my gods with your God. And I just really like that. This really shows that this is absolute commitment on her part. And to me, absolute surrender and absolute faith. She does it willingly. She does it freely. She does it voluntarily. She doesn't do it with any hesitation. It's just all out. Now, I thought about all the examples we could look at in the Bible of people that actually make a commitment to God and acknowledge Him, but only when circumstances force them to do it. Remember Nebuchadnezzar, when he had that dream and nobody could interpret that dream, and Daniel came before him and gave him the interpretation of that dream. That's in Daniel, the second chapter of Daniel. And at the end of that interpretation, Nebuchadnezzar says, of a truth, your God is a God above or of the gods, and he is the Lord of kings, and he is the revealer of secrets. So Nebuchadnezzar actually acknowledged Daniel's God, but he was forced to do that by those circumstances. But he did acknowledge him. And then he again acknowledged the God of Israel when the three Hebrew children were in the fiery furnace. And when they were not touched by the fire from that fiery furnace, and he saw that fourth person walking about in that furnace, he said, blessed be the God of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. He acknowledged their God, but circumstances forced him to do it. And then the third time is when Nebuchadnezzar was lifted up in himself, and the Lord struck him with, I guess you could say, insanity. He lost his mind for 7 years. When he came to his senses after that time frame, he did acknowledge and honor Daniel's God, and he called him the King of Heaven. But in all those instances, when he, through those circumstances, acknowledged their God, he didn't once absolutely surrender to that God, because he didn't leave his other gods. Now, Ruth is different. You would think circumstances would force her back to her gods because, gee, nothing's going well for me. Everything's going against me. But instead, she turns freely and voluntarily to the God of Naomi of her own free will. And not just part of the way, but all of the way. Because she said, okay, I'm giving up my gods. And I'm giving up my people. And so you really see this in her testimony, a testimony of faith and a testimony of love and a testimony of service and a testimony of discipleship and a testimony of fellowship, which I want you to think about those categories, because in Genesis 12:1, we have the account where God calls Abram. And remember, he says, get thee out. Anybody remember what Abram's response is? It says, and Abram departed. And so there is this testimony of faith. Abraham was willing to leave Ur of the Chaldees because he simply believed what God said. And he let go of everything. And if we have a testimony of faith, we're willing to let go of things and just step out into the unknown, which is what she's doing. Her foot's going forward, and she doesn't know where it's going to take her. She's never seen that land or met those people, and I'll bet she's going to have to really work at learning the language a little better than she does now. And also there's this testimony of love, which we've talked about, because just like Abraham had this testimony of faith, remember we talked about Rachel when Abraham's servant Eliezer invited her to come back with him and marry Abraham's son Isaac. And we talked about the question that was asked, wilt thou go with this man? And she said, I will go. And that to me is a testimony of love. In Genesis 24. The other example of a testimony of love is I thought about Psalm 45:10 in the description of that woman there in that psalm. And one of the things that is said concerning her is, forget also thine own people and thy father's house. Well, why would she do that? Because she loves somebody more. And so Ruth is going to love Naomi and Naomi's God more than she loves her people and her gods. It's a testimony of love. The other aspect of this, a choice that she makes, I think is a testimony. It's a testimony of faith. It's a testimony of love. And then it's a testimony of service. Because we have two examples in the Bible of those that are called upon to serve. And one of those examples we read, I think, a couple weeks ago in 2 Kings in the second chapter, when Elijah calls Elijah. And we read that portion in 2 Kings 2 where Elijah calls him and he says, well, let me go and say goodbye to my father and my mother. And he went and said goodbye to him and he followed him. But later on, when you get to 2 Kings, and Elijah is at the end of his ministry, and he knows the Lord is going to carry him away, several times Elijah says to his servant Elijah, and he's actually called him his servant, and Elijah calls Elijah his master. Elijah says, go back. And Elijah says, I will not leave thee. I will not leave thee. He says that in 2 Kings 2:2, and he says, repeats it several times, I will not leave thee. And when others come and tell him that the Lord is going to take away his master, he says, I will not leave him because I'm his servant. And so if you are a true servant of the Lord, there is that commitment that you are there to serve and you are there in whatever capacity the Lord wants to call you, and you will say, I will not leave thee. Elisha would not leave Elijah. The other example that I thought was really good is there's a man in 2 Samuel by the name of Ittai. He's one of David's 37 mighty men. He had 37 mighty men. One of them that we know of was Bathsheba's husband. But Ittai, I-T-T-A-I, is found in 2 Samuel 15. And if you read verses 19 through 22, one of the things that we find is when David is kind of forced to flee, Ittai wants to go with him. And David really says to him, go back. David says to him, return to thy place, go back, stay. And it says in 2 Samuel 15, 21, and Ittai answered, surely in what place my lord the king shall be, whether in life or death, even there also will thy servant be. Isn't that really good? So that's 2 Kings 15:21. He really says, I am your servant, and in whatever place you are, because you are my lord and my king, that's the place that I will be, in life or in death. And that's what Naomi's saying here. So you see in her that faith testimony, that love testimony, and the testimony of a true servant. And I just think that's so wonderful. In a sense, she is a true disciple, because remember we talked about what Jesus taught his disciples. If you really want to be my disciple, who do you have to leave? Father and mother and brother and sister. You have to forsake all. You have to be willing. And actually, one of the things that Jesus said is, if you aren't willing to do this, then you're not worthy of me. He says that in Matthew 10. And in Luke, he says, you cannot be my disciple. But in Matthew, he says, you're just not worthy of me if you're not willing to commit all the way. And Ruth is willing to commit all the way. And so that's what we see in her, this testimony of, I don't care what you say to me, I'm going with you. That's Matthew 10:37 and Luke 14:26 through 27. That's the testimony of discipleship. And the last testimony that I had, because I had several of them there, is the testimony of fellowship. And that is the two men that walked on the road to Emmaus with Jesus, and they didn't want him to leave them. It wasn't, we won't leave you, it's please don't leave us. And to me, that's the testimony of fellowship. So you have that testimony of faith and that testimony of love and that testimony of a servant and that testimony of discipleship and that testimony of fellowship.